Welcome to Why I Hate My Team. I'm Bobby Wagner, the producer of the Ringer MLB show. I am joined in studio by Sean Fennessy. Sean, I don't see any point in wasting any time getting down to this. You're a very public-facing New York Mets fan, as I guess am I now. Sean, what is making you the most angry about the Mets this week? We could start in one of two places. We could start with the Diaz and Cano trade, or we could start with famed manager Mickey Callaway. Where do you want to start?
I think we got to start with the former so that we can get to the latter.
Okay.
So we're going to start with the Diaz Cano trade, as you call it. I call it the Cano trade.
Yes, I know you do.
There is a reason for that, because I do believe that he was the key piece in this trade, and he is vexing me as he has been vexing me all season.
I've been a footnote to you with this throughout the season, mentioning Diaz's name every time you try to talk about Robinson Cano's hamstrings.
Yes, and somehow the tables have turned in my favor, because Edwin Diaz, it turns out, is perhaps not the most elite closer in baseball, which is what I was sold.
Maybe not anymore. You've been against this trade from literally the very beginning, the day that it happened. And I think you're one of the only people that's not just like a bot on Mets Twitter that has been full-throatedly against this from the very beginning that I know. And I guess I just, to set a foundation here, where were you at when you saw this trade? Did it carry too much like past history for you?
That's a factor. It's twofold. One, some of it is from a place of ignorance, because I'm not an American League fan. I have not spent a lot of time watching Edwin Diaz pitch. When it was communicated to me that this was a trade for Diaz and not a trade for now Mets general manager Brody Van Wagenen's former client Robinson Cano, I couldn't escape that mentality. The idea that an agent was bringing in one of his guys to join this team that also happened to feature a few more of his guys, and that he was essentially unionizing them together all under his banner, I was very suspicious of that in general. But I didn't know very much about Diaz other than the fact that his counting numbers were incredible. He was certainly one of the three or four best relievers in baseball last year. And I can see value in that, but making a deal for a closer at that level only makes sense if you are a team in search of 93 or 94 wins. And I was not convinced that the team that they had put together was that kind of a team. And so because of that, Robinson Cano is 36 years old. He's in his 37th year. He turns 37 in October. And he's an infielder who's had a history of injuries and PED abuse. And that's just not a formula for success. And he's got four more years left on his contract. And of course, the Mets are famed for their bad deals with aging players whose production slows quite rapidly. And so you're right. I felt haunted by ghosts. And I also felt haunted by logic. It just logically, I could not make sense of what they were trying to do other than just BVW taking care of his guy.
Yeah, I think I was hoping for Edwin Diaz to transcend the season from hellness that is every year for the Mets, because he had the season from heaven last year. You know, like his peripherals matched up actually with the performance on the field in a very favorable way. And now he's not. I mean, I think we need to not overreact a little bit. Like I hate to be small sample size guy, because I know it's a lot more fun to overreact, and that's kind of like the point of this podcast. But Diaz is not going to be the worst closer in baseball all season. I understand your concern about Cano.
I think part of the issue with Diaz is his failures have been operatic, and they feel reminiscent of players who played in small markets and were very successful and came to big markets and couldn't hack it. Now, whether that's utter mythology or not, it is now a part of the narrative about him. And there was a lot of conversation in recent days about whether or not he can really cut it. And Gene Segura, the Phillies infielder who hit a game-winning home run off of
his former teammate,
was asked about this and talked about it and noted that he may not enjoy all the attention he's getting in New York.
I wouldn't either.
And so whether or not that's a factor, it is part of the conversation around it. I will also say the blown saves he's had in particular have been high drama. They have been 2-3 home run innings from a guy who I think gave up all of 5 home runs last year. I mean, he was virtually, no one could take him out of the park last season. And yeah, I think he's now given up upwards of 8 home runs, which is just ludicrous for a closer less than halfway through the season.
Almost if like this was a movie, you tear up the script and throw it back and say, what are you doing?
Absolutely. It's a little bit too much. And you know, frankly, personally, you and I were both present for a very painful blown Edwin Diaz save at Dodger Stadium earlier this year in May.
In person.
And that really colored my perception, because it was a night when he just didn't have it. And sometimes your closer just doesn't have it. But he was pitching to the best team in baseball, and the Mets were going to be very fortunate to get out of there with a win because they had survived a Noah Syndergaard less than sharp start. They had gotten some key hitting. And Diaz just was terrible. I mean, just truly terrible, and was battered. And you know, we can talk about Cano now and how upsetting it is to watch a 37-year-old man drag his ass around the infield in Citi Field, but the Diaz thing hurts a little bit more because I have had smart people like you and like Michael Bauman tell me that this is who the trade was for, and he's not living up.
Don't let me con you into thinking that I'm smart about baseball.
Well, I mean, I don't want to believe that I am, but I'm starting to think I might be, at least when it comes to the Mets.
The Diaz thing, the Dodgers game, and I think this game yesterday with the Phillies, we're recording this on a Friday afternoon in LA time. So those are kind of like the tentpole moments of the season for why shit has been hitting the fan.
Yes.
I do want to move to kind of that usage of him because that Dodgers game was atrocious and yesterday was as well. But before we do that, I just want to say one last point on Cano. And I think some of the people who are more optimistic, who care about baseball on not only just an X's and O's level, but on a clubhouse level. And I'm one of those people. I kind of believe in the idea that having partnering Cano with an up the middle partner of Amen Rosario, who's a young prospect who needs to learn how to be a middle infielder in New York under a lot of pressure, I think that has value. I think that has intrinsic value that wasn't really talked about at the time of the trade. The people who were pro-trade were saying, Cano's actually been a better hitter than you think he has for the last few years. And that's fine. I was okay with that, but I think I admitted to myself pretty early on that he wasn't going to be a better hitter than Jeff McNeil. So we're going to be playing Jeff McNeil out of position just to get his bat in the lineup, which seems like something that the Mets haven't figured out that they're not supposed to do. But what do you make of the sort of old-timier, he's a good clubhouse guy for someone like Amen Rosario? Do you throw that out the window?
I don't throw it out the window, but I don't think that the Mets are a total youth effort. I think Jacob DeGrom is a veteran pitcher at this stage
he's
of his
be
career.
Next year.
Todd Frazier is in the clubhouse. There are guys there that are... it wasn't all kids on this team. And also, as far as I can tell, Jeff McNeil, Pete Alonso, Dom Smith, Michael Conforto, these guys are not immature, dumb shit, amateur players. They're professional players who just happen to be in their 20s and who carry themselves with a kind of a grace and professionalism. Now, I'm projecting. I don't actually know if that's true, but the Mets are famed for a lot of off-field messes historically, famously in the 80s, famously in the 90s, famously in the O's. We don't hear any stories about Jeff McNeil or Pete Alonso or Michael Conforto. And to me, the desire for Amen Rosario to need a partner like that, I would just much rather have, frankly, and the reason that the trade drove me so crazy in the first place is because the move was very clear to me. The move was sign Manny Machado and let Jeff McNeil play second base.
100%.
And then you have four 25-year-olds in your infield and you're set for 5 years. That was the move. And then it's actually okay if Amen Rosario just hits 240 and gets on base at a 290 clip because you've got Manny Machado who's hitting 35 home runs in Citi Field. And they didn't do that. And they took on a Robinson Cano contract that is maybe not the worst contract in baseball, but it's going to look really bad in about 18 months when it's dead money. It's a dead $40 to $60 million. And so it's not that I discount the need for clubhouse mentality. You and I are in a workplace together. We know that there's some people who are glue guys in the office. There's some people who make you feel better about your day-to-day. There's some people who, you know, make you feel worse about your day-to-day. And you want more glue guys than guys who make you feel worse. And I don't really know enough about Robinson Cano to say whether he is or he isn't. He's obviously been haunted by rumors of dogging it on the field in the past. You guys on the MLB show recently talked about that idea. I'm not as emotionally distraught by whether he's a lazy player or not.
I mean, yes.
But there is controversy that has always trailed Cano throughout his career, too, and especially his time in New York.
I think a lot of the controversy stems from being a non-white player who's a star for the New York Yankees.
No doubt.
Okay, let's move on to Mickey Callaway.
What are we doing here with him? Why is this still happening?
One of the core frustrations, I think, for Mets fans, besides the fact that he tried to fight a reporter, and do we even need to assess that? But one of the core frustrations, just an unbelievable error. One of the core frustrations, I think, has been that he was hired under the premise that he's a pitching coach. This is a pitching-based team. He can make some of the decisions that Terry Collins wasn't capable of making with the bullpen. For literally since I was an infant, this team has never really been able to make the correct decisions, except for 2015, and they ended up in the World Series. And, you know, that's retroactive logic on my part. I'm sure that they were fine with their bullpen in years that they were bad, that they were just a bad baseball team. As it relates specifically to Diaz, I think a lot of these issues are conflating because Callaway has used Diaz for 30 or more pitches on a second straight day of work three times already this season. And that's the same amount as the rest of his career combined.
I get the impression candidly that Mickey Callaway doesn't know how to manage not just the bullpen, but a staff in general. And I don't know what he was specifically hired for. I think that that Indians staff that he oversaw was extremely gifted, and that's why they were successful.
Sure.
And it's a little hard to know what kind of influence a pitching coach has in a system like that with that kind of flexible staff and bullpen, where they had guys who could be firemen and pitch 2-3 innings. They had a strong closer. They had 2 Cy Young candidates on their staff. A guy like that getting credit for that kind of work and also just seeming like a very put together and serious man, which is how Callaway presents, even though he's under fire, except when he's challenging a reporter to a fight, I guess is kind of what swayed the Wilpons into hiring him. But tactically speaking, you can cite a stat like the one you just did. Even just if you look at his between sort of mid-inning replacement strategy, he is routinely wrong. And some of this stuff is a moving target, and whether Seth Lugo should be coming in with 2 outs and a runner on base or Robert Gsellman should be pitching a 3rd inning in after working the day before, all that stuff is probably ultimately incidental, but he just seems to have chosen wrong almost every time. No team has blown more leads after the 7th inning than the Mets in baseball.
Yeah.
And he doesn't seem to have a very good bullpen to begin with, and not knowing how to deploy a limited staff is a reason that managers get fired. This is why guys get fired. And for whatever reason, Mickey Callaway is still here. Why is that?
I think because it's like the Wilpons, what is the other option? Because if you're running this team, and a lot of these things seem like it's sort of divine that these off-the-field issues keep popping up, what is a new manager going to do for your bottom line if you have clearly demonstrated already that the ultimate goal for you is not necessarily winning? Because if the ultimate goal was winning, they would have done what you said and signed Manny Machado.
Do we agree that this team has a lot of talent?
Yes.
Do they have the 2nd or 3rd best slugger in baseball?
Yes.
Do they have arguably the best pitcher in baseball?
Yes. He hasn't been the best pitcher in baseball this year, but yes.
No, but I would argue that especially in the last month or so, he's been the 2nd or 3rd best.
Back on track.
And that is, those are rare commodities.
Sure.
A Pete Alonso season like the one we're getting right now is a rare commodity. And so...
Hopefully not.
Well, I mean, hopefully not for him. But because you have players like that, and because you have a certain kind of energy, and frankly, this is the liveliest Mets offense I've seen in years.
Yes.
And because of all of those things, and because you still have Noah Syndergaard and his arm on your team, and you still have not yet traded some of your other pitchers that you're going to have to trade at the deadline because they're going to be free agents, if you fire him and you hire, say, a Jack McKeon type, who is a veteran guy, who is good in the clubhouse, who knows how to utilize his bench and knows how to utilize his bullpen, and has a little bit of cult of personality that can draw attention away from his players, maybe make a run at things. The NL East had been very soft for 2+ months, and I could see a change of pace. Now, there was a lot of talk about a month ago about somebody like Dusty Baker.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that the Wilpons would ever bring a Dusty Baker into the Mets organization. The Mets have very rarely hired a high-profile manager.
No.
It's not something they're more likely to hire your Willie Randolph types.
Well, there's a reason that Terry Collins is the longest running manager in the Mets history.
What reason is that?
Because he's just he's like talking to this wall. Yes. I mean, I love Terry.
I did too.
Love him.
He's a very agreeable guy.
Yes, exactly. And he was never the center of attention on this team, which is why a guy like Matt Harvey rose to success so fast, because he was like the only personality on the team at the time. I do want to briefly defend Mickey Callaway, if you can accept something quite as insane.
Take your best shot.
When you're, as a GM, your plan is to sign Wilmer Font to be used very regularly after the Rays DFA'd him within this season. The Rays, who many believe, and I believe, are the smartest team in baseball, DFA'd him because they know that not even they can fix him with their advanced analytics and scouting. And your plan is to sign him and use him regularly when you had tens of millions of dollars in cap space to sign relievers or to sign whoever in this offseason. And you have this 1 foot in the door on contention with the Edwin Diaz trade. And we haven't even talked about the prospects that they gave up to get him. I don't think we need to, because we're not prospect analysts. But
I believe Jared Kelenic in low A and high A is slugging .570. And that's probably what he'll be slugging when he gets to the majors in 2 years.
He had a 180 WRC plus at high A, or at low A, and they moved him up to high A within like 30 games.
It's just not what you want if you're a Met fan.
when that's the well you have to go back to as a manager, I'm not saying he's a good manager, but I don't know if Joe Maddon could fix this. You know, I don't know if Dave Roberts is pulling in Wilmer Font instead of Pedro Baez and it's working out.
I think there have definitely been mistakes made. The Jurys Familia contract is a complete disaster.
It's a concoction of issues that have just put Mickey Callaway in front of the camera as the guy who is just blundering his way through all of it.
And then challenging people to fight him, which I think just exacerbated everything.
Yeah.
You know, I think he felt a bit hapless and a bit like a victim of Mets ineptitude. And now he has drawn attention to himself and made him seem villainous.
He's sort of playing a manager on TV, though. Like getting mad out of nowhere after he's seemingly a pretty straight-laced guy for the rest of the time and trying to act like he's a Billy Martin type who wants to fight a reporter, and Billy Martin had punched a guy and he's trying to cite that as how he manages his club. It's like, no, you don't, dude. There were stories in this offseason by James Wagner in the New York Times talking about how you're part of this new wave of touchy-feely managers who want to connect to your players. You're not a punch a reporter in the face kind of manager, but now you're just playing one on TV because you're in this New York media cycle.
I completely agree with you. I think, you know, in fairness to him, he's probably never had an experience like this. He's fighting for his job.
Sure.
He's fighting for his job. And a guy like Mickey Callaway getting fired after 20 months in his first full-time managerial role, you know, he'll probably catch on as a pitching coach somewhere, but he may never be a manager ever again in his life.
Yeah.
And this was the opportunity of a lifetime in the biggest market in the world. And he's just been very blah. I thought last season he was very blah too. You know, we can say that he deserves credit for Jacob DeGrom's incredible achievements, but as a couple of guys who've been watching Jacob DeGrom really closely, it wasn't that shocking that DeGrom became that good. Now, I think there was some statistical anomaly in his performance last year.
I don't think it was shocking at all.
But he was legitimately impressive for three seasons before that. And
or hurt.
Or
legitimately
hurt.
Impressive or his elbow hurt.
Exactly. And he is the kind of pitcher that at age 29 tends to do that sort of thing. There is some precedent for that. So I'm not really sure what it is Mickey has ever done in New York that has granted him the benefit of the doubt from me.
He has a good name and a good chin.
He does. He does. He's swole.
He's pretty swole.
He's got some biceps.
He has the forearm thing, you know, that like older strong men have.
He does. I have some beard envy with him. You know, his beard grows full in his cheeks. You know, there's a certain kind of man.
He gets that thing lined up pretty frequently.
He does. He's probably spending too much time on his beard, if we're being honest.
Okay, let's take one quick step back. I want to talk about the cycle on all of these things, the media cycle on all of these things, because it seems like everyone points to incompetence and starts ringing the alarm bells faster than any team. And in the past, I've sort of tried to be defensive of that because the Mets' incompetence, while incompetent, is kind of similar to a lot of other teams. Like, they've been bad in weird ways, but they haven't been worse than the Phillies in the last 8 years.
Well, I think that they are prone to media-centric disasters.
Sure.
And that exacerbates a lot of the problems. There's a couple of factors this season. One, it's the 50th anniversary of the 1969 team, which I was not alive at that time, but if you speak to anyone who was, it's just one of the most purely enjoyable sports stories ever. And there was something so shocking about that team. And if you go to their only other championship team, 1986, which celebrated an anniversary 3 years ago, that team was tabbed for a kind of greatness that it never achieved, aside from that one season. And
by accident, almost.
Yeah, it should have been dynastic and wasn't. And so pretty much ever since 69, the team has come close but not quite done it. And existing in that kind of Queens atmosphere of sports fandom, which often includes, for guys like me, the Jets and the Knicks, another pair of hapless teams, there is this Bermuda Triangle of pain in sports fandom.
Sure.
And so even if things are not as bad, let's say things are worse right now for, I don't know, the Baltimore Orioles, right? Let's say that's a team that just doesn't know what it's doing.
We'll be talking to Mallory Rubin in a few minutes on this show, so yes.
So like at least we're not 30 games back in June. However, the Baltimore Orioles seem to have a plan, which is
exactly
to just bottom out and do what the Astros did and draft effectively and build an amazing roster of number one and number two picks. And the Mets' plan is to make the playoffs, and they have no chance to make the playoffs right now. They do not look anything like a playoff team. And so invariably, because they are failing in real time at their goal, it's easy to know that they are just a mess. And are we overstating things? Yeah.
Yeah.
We root for a team in New York, and that's what we do. We overstate things. But it's a badly run team with bad ownership and has been for decades.
So the bad ownership thing is something I want to talk about, and I hate to invoke the Knicks, but I'm going to invoke the Knicks. When something goes wrong with this team or with the Knicks, it goes from this was a mistake. We're kind of at a 5 in terms of how mad we are. And then you see people tweeting about it, and we're kind of at a 7. And then you see people pointing out things that you haven't thought about, and then you're at a 9. And then they blow a save the next day, and you're at a 10. And then you start pointing at Mickey Callaway, but you're like, this is Mickey Callaway. I don't really care about this guy that much. Then the next finger that gets pointed is at Fred and Jeff Wilpon. Is there any way as fans or as media members to have an intelligent conversation about a team where everything gets pointed towards the owner? Because I just don't know whether it's even worth having some of these conversations sometimes that we see play out if it's just really just the rotten fruit is in ownership this year. Like, what's the point of analyzing Mickey Callaway using a guy for 30 pitches when he shouldn't be using a guy for 30 pitches if the real problem here is that they won't open the checkbooks?
I think there's a correlation. You know, I think sometimes you get lucky with a first-time manager. Sometimes Joe Maddon gets his first job and you realize, oh my God, this is the most sophisticated mind ever when he went to the Rays, I believe. And sometimes you get a Mickey Callaway. And both of those things are a function of a kind of cheapness around the edges. You know, the Rays are famously not a very wealthy team. We imagine the Mets are, but they don't spend like it. And so because of that, you get first-time general manager Brody Van Wagenen, first-time manager Mickey Callaway.
That was a Freudian slip.
That's
over-managing from his couch.
It's a whole other issue that we can unpack. But because of those things, and Jeff Wilpon and James Dolan have a lot in common, which is that they are scions of men who built great fortunes, and those fortunes have come under duress over the years, but their place as the owners of the teams has never been challenged, and they have no desire to sell those teams because their identity is baked into owning those teams. Now, mm-hmm. It has gotten to a point where that ownership has corrupted their sense of self, and they seem almost defiant of all conventional wisdom, and they seem oppositional to the media, which is always castigating them at every turn.
Yeah, they're in their shell.
And they do what they want to do. They have an insulation. They have huge wall of insulation made of $100 bills. And unfortunately, we're never going to be able to breach that because the money will talk and they will not. And they'll do what they want to do with their money. Now, James Dolan, to his credit, will spend money. He has always spent money. He has always gone over the tax. He has never complained about that. Jeff Wilpon's a different story. You know, he and his father have a complicated and complex relationship to money, in part because of the Bernie Madoff scandal, but also just the perception that they are lesser than Steinbrenners. You know, George Steinbrenner would do anything at all costs for his team to win, and I have just literally never felt that way about the Mets.
Okay. I can't let us out of here without doing a little bit of silver lining talk.
Okay.
I want to know how your conversation with a tattoo artist is going for your polar bear Pete Alonso tattoo.
It's already on my back. It takes up every inch of my back. I mean, this is great. We've literally never had this as Mets fans. We've never had a slugger like this. I mentioned this to Bill Simmons, and he said, well, yeah, well, you had Strawberry. Look at Strawberry's numbers. They are not like this.
No. Well, he also wasn't playing with a beach ball.
That's a fair point. And the ball is juiced, and I acknowledge it. Nevertheless, nobody is hitting the juiced ball harder
You're
than
right.
Pete Alonso.
He has the Mets like 10 hardest hit by StatCast, which started in 2015.
Yes. He is a stat wonder, and he's also an in-person wonder. He hits balls that make you remember why baseball is so fun.
He's a very pick things up and put them down kind of guy.
Definitely.
Which, you know, I love. It's funny. He actually does have a little bit of a personality if you dig behind the Florida. I am extremely excited. I don't want to invoke the David Wright name yet, but it feels very similar, and the Mets found ways to pretty much fuck up David Wright's entire career until the end.
I'm so nervous about this with Pete.
Me too.
I really don't know what to expect. He's obviously going to participate in the Home Run Derby, which is exciting as a fan, though the part of me that understands the history of the Home Run Derby knows that maybe this is not so good for a guy who's on pace to hit 55 home runs.
I like conspiracies, but that's a myth.
Okay, so I'll let you be the standard bearer on that point. Regardless, in theory, everything actually worked out perfectly, which is that there was a case 2 years ago that Pete should have been in the majors, and there was certainly a case last year that Pete should have been in the majors, and neither time he was. There was somebody in front of him on a bad contract, be it Jay Bruce or somebody else. We're now in this weird position where Dom Smith, he might be the only person that Mickey Callaway has weirdly done right by, because when he gets him looks, he looks like a major league hitter in a big way.
McNeil as well.
That's fair. But Pete Alonso seems right on time. It seems like he got off the plane, stepped onto the field, and was a 50 home run guy. And I've never been able to root for somebody like this. It's an incredible feeling.
He's the only inevitable, you know?
He is. He's the Thanos of the Mets in many ways.
That feels like as good a time as any to end this podcast before you start talking about MCU.
Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks, Sean. All right, we're back. I have Mallory Rubin in studio with me. Mallory, I'm very, very sorry to sort of pick at this scab, pick at this wound. I guess it's not even a scab yet for you. I think that's where I wanted to start with you.
There's been no healing.
Why you hate your team this week, I think, is because Manny Machado returned to Baltimore.
Wow. And
he returned loudly.
You're just going for it right away.
I'm just going for it right away. This is a brief podcast, so.
It's all about efficiency and cruelty, apparently.
It is. I guess where I want to start is, I know you were very publicly upset for 2 calendar years. So it was a weird thing to kind of unfold in slow motion and then all come to a head with a trade to the city that you live in. So now that you have, I guess, like 6 months out, where is your head at?
It's weird that you think that amount of time is enough for me to gain any sort of perspective.
I know. I guess I should know who I'm talking to.
You know, this is a very complicated time to be an Oriole fan, and it's certainly a complicated time to continue to love Manny Machado as I do and always will. He's been a very important sporting figure in my life, but when he comes into Camden Yards in a different uniform, that feels like shit.
Yeah.
There's kind of no other way to put it. And he struck out in his first at bat. There was a nice moment where he acknowledged the crowd. You know, certainly like the requisite like smattering of boos, but I thought it was mostly like a very pleasantly positive reception. There was the little welcome back Manny sign on the Jumbotron and people cheered for him and there was a standing ovation. You know, all of these are sort of general terms given that there are 4 people in attendance at every Oriole game. And as the next at bat, he hit a home run and it was like a shiv in the heart. I can't express how bad it felt to watch him hit a home run in Camden Yards where he spent the first near decade of his career blossoming into the one of the brightest and most gifted stars in the game, and to see him return and do something operatic and wonderful for another team. But I am now at the point where I'm at least trying to talk myself into progress, growth.
This is what I was going to ask you next.
Trying to move on.
So when you see Machado come back, you see him hit a home run, you see him, you know, thriving to some extent with his new team. Like, it's
slow
a young
start, but it's coming together.
Exactly.
Now.
Yeah. It's a young team, and he's been, I think, a positive influence for that young team, and they're very fun to watch. I've watched many more Padres games than all Orioles games this year.
That's great. That's just great to hear. Could it be because the Orioles are 30 games back and it's June?
I actually ended up watching the first Chris Davis home run, which happened to be the first Chris Davis hit of the year. Oh my God. That was a weird experience for me. But when you watch Manny come back, does it fill you with rage towards the front office, or is it more of just like a sadness kind of thing?
I'd say that no emotions are mutually exclusive. You know, we all contain multitudes, and I can feel many things at once, especially when it comes to the Orioles. But that's part of that question, I think, gets to the heart of how I'm sort of like viewing this next evolution of fandom. There's a new front office now.
Yeah.
And so any kind of rage or bitterness that I have about that trade and what happened, I don't put that on the current regime. And so I think that, look, you know, this is what I wrote at the time. This is what I said at the time. The thing that hurts so much about the Manny trade, it's not that it didn't make sense from a baseball perspective to try to turn a guy you know you're not going to re-sign into assets. Like, of course, that's part of sports. The thing that was so upsetting to me at the time is you acquire prospects for one reason and one reason only, because you pray that one day one of them can turn into a player like Manny Machado. They already had him, and they made no effort. That was the part that hurt, is the making no effort. And it's not like the prior decade of Orioles baseball, well, this team had languished in irrelevance for 15 years. You know, Manny Machado was on 3 playoff teams in 5 years.
Yeah.
That Oriole team had the best record in the American League while he was on it for that stretch of time, not his entire career.
Shockingly.
Obviously.
Shout out to Buck.
Incredible stuff from Buck! And so to not attempt to foster and nurture that success and see if it could be sustained, I really think, and I'm sure you would agree, that we're in an era of baseball now where you're either attempting to be a super team or to tank. And those are the only paths to sustained success or to success in any form. And what was frustrating about the Orioles strategy the last couple of years and culminating in the Machado trade and, you know, letting Adam Jones go, et cetera, the Britton trade, is that they seem to be attempting to just kind of exist in the middle without a clear strategy. If trading Machado had been part of a full rebuild, a full tank, which now it is, again, with a different regime, then of course it would have hurt, but I would have understood the logic. So now I'm moving on to that point where Michael Elias has taken over as GM. And I think with every decision that he makes, you feel that Astros DNA fueling it. And it's hard not to get excited about that. So yeah. I don't look at the team this year and say, oh my God, 22 wins at the end of June, 30 games out of first place.
That's
at
a
the
basketball
end of June,
record.
On pace for 117 losses. I look at that and I say, okay, like, does this feel great day in and day out? Of course not. Is it embarrassing? Sure. But do I hate my team? No, Bobby, I do not. I love that my team is finally fully in on the intended approach. How did the Astros and Cubs win titles? Because they were content to lose more than 100 games until they were able to build up the building blocks that were necessary to sustain the team for success. So who else was in Camden Yards the same day as Manny Machado?
Adley Rutschman.
That's right.
That was my next question. Does it make you gun shy, though, to have watched a star come up, succeed, and then the organization not give the infrastructure to keep that star in place for a decade as opposed to just the 5 years that Manny was there?
Well, of course. You know, it's hard to not carry the trauma from the past with you forever. But I also, again, I think sports are cyclical just as much in life as cyclical. And it's we're right on the heels of the Manny era ending the way it did, but we're not that far removed from something like Cal Ripken spending his entire career in Baltimore and Brooks Robinson winning 16 gold gloves in Baltimore. I mean, the Orioles used to be one of the poster franchises for not only perennial excellence and contention, but for being a place where players wanted to spend their entire careers. So I would hope, I mean, that's what you have to kind of hang on to as a fan that loves your team, is that you can get back to that point where you are a place people want to be. Now, I actually look at something like not re-signing Adam Jones as like a greater indictment in that sense, because you know, as just a human being in the world, that Manny Machado is going to command a $300 million contract, right? So if you're not going to do that, then move on.
It was in question for a little while there, but it ended up coming through.
A little while. Weird offseason. Adam Jones refused to be traded during the season for various reasons, but because in part it was so important to him to manage the end of his career on his own terms in a way that I really respect and admire, and because he had built up so much equity as not only a player, but a person in Baltimore and with the Orioles. You can't give a guy like that a year or two to stay there and be a veteran presence and help mold these young players who are coming up. It's not about, oh, well, does it make sense for Adam Jones in terms of what our record is going to be, or whether we're going to finish in fifth place in the American League East or in fifth place with a worse record in the American League East. Yeah. Like, this team was going to be what it was going to be this year. And the flip side to that is obvious, which is, well, look at what's happening with Chris Davis, and not that Adam Jones is the same player as Chris Davis, obviously, but investing in any way in a veteran presence when it doesn't make sense for the team you're trying to field, you're just blocking at some point a prospect who you need to assess. But when this roster broke camp, the prospects were not out there.
No.
So that's part of where it gets confounding.
I think that's sort of like what you kind of have to accept when you do that Astros and Cubs style rebuild, is like they don't really care about or they have the reputation as not really caring about bringing back Adam Jones or veterans or Adam Jones types as clubhouse influences, because they don't anticipate that these people are going to be in the clubhouse in 3 to 5 years anyway.
And that's, again, like I understand that. But to your question then about, well, when you're thinking about forecasting the next decade with a player like Adley, can you even allow yourself to think, okay, well, after his first contract expires and he becomes
no,
a free
you shouldn't
agent,
allow yourself
this person
to think
is going
to
want to be here? Well, I don't know. That's pretty far into the future. All I can do right now is hope that every Photoshop out there of the old Matt Wieters SI, the perfect catch cover that now has Adley Rutschman's face on it, leads to some sort of better result than the Wieters era did. I did.
You weren't a fan?
No, I mean, I loved Matt Wieters. I loved him. But I did think he was going to be like, you know, Johnny Bench, and then he obviously was not. So I thought that there was something really poetically resonant about the Adley Rutschman contract signing, record bonus, and then Camden Yards introduction happening the same day that Manny Machado returned to the park.
Yeah.
That was like
going 2 for 4 with a home run.
Yeah. I mean, in a way that was both really sad, but also in a way that if you choose to allow yourself to think this way and don't consider it a self-delusion, a way that is really hopeful. You know, one book closes and then we all have the ability to open another one if we want to, you know? And that's kind of how it felt. And I think also that moment, again, this is why I do not hate my team, even though it's been a trying year. I love my team. It's a microcosm of what this season is for Orioles fans. It's not actually about the present, really, in any way.
Yeah.
Like, am I excited about Trey Mancini getting to be an All-Star? Sure, of course. I love Trey Mancini.
Yeah.
But it's not about what's happening on the field this year. It's about the past and it's about the future. And it's really just a question of how long or short the bridge between those things is.
Yeah. As someone whose team does not have any sort of plan anywhere evident, I would say enjoy the plan. Mal, thank you for doing this.
Thanks, Wags.